way, but I just want to tell you, and that is that we have an Amati violin in the ensemble. Linda, come here. This is Linda Melstedt. Here's her Amati violin, okay, from Cremona, the real thing. All right, so so far, that violin's from 1670. We're going to skip ahead now to around 1710. So far, we looked at the printing process, and the Italian economy, and the developments in the design of the violin, and all three of those factors come together for the few years around 1710, and they have an enormous impact on everything that follows. First of all, in 1708, a young composer moved from Mühlhausen to Weimar to the job as house organist for the Duke in Weimar, one of the Dukes, there were a few of them, and one of that Duke's sons, Prince Johann Ernst, was a keen musician. He composed his own music, he was a good violinist, he traveled for lessons often, and to find new music to play. And that's why he spent 2 years in Holland, in Utrecht, starting in 1709. Now that same year, 1709, in Venice, the brilliant violinist, priest, and composer Antonio Vivaldi was let go from his teaching job at the Ospedale della Pietà. He'd been teaching at La Pietà for 6 years. We don't know why he was fired. There are a few possible reasons. One might be that he refused to say the Mass. Although he was a priest, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. He said it was because of a respiratory ailment. I don't know. How hard could it be, right? I mean, he could play the violin. He could travel. More likely, he was fairly well known to have had a girlfriend who was a female soprano, fairly prominent soprano in Venice. And the rumor is that maybe that sort of put him in a bad light with the papacy, and he didn't want to raise his head too high. So he just wanted to keep a low profile. That's one of the possibilities. The other possibility is that he taught himself out of a job. He was a great teacher, and the students, the musical students at La Pietà, were famously excellent. And when the governors came to renew his salary, if his job was making the orchestra sound good, they already sounded good, so they didn't need him anymore. That's actually quite plausible. At any rate, the economy in Northern Europe was much stronger than it was in Italy, which was still suffering from that giant recession that had started almost at this point 100 years before. So he went around Northern Europe, probably looking for work to begin with, but when he got there, was a busy, music-loving, wealthy class who would buy his music. So instead of moving north to play for those people, he simply sent his music north and sold it to them. Now, in 1711, Vivaldi published a set of violin concertos that were directed exactly to those people, said right on the front, to amateur musicians. And he published them without using the famous Venetian printers, whose type method was very quickly going out of style. All those little bits of type, by this point, other things had progressed, and they were messy, and there were lots of mistakes, and it was clumsy and slow, and he didn't like it. Instead, he chose the master engraver from Holland, Estienne Roger, and Roger published Vivaldi's Opus 3 concertos. Now that same year, our prince from Weimar, Johann Ernst, finished his lessons in Utrecht and went to Amsterdam, and bought a copy of those Vivaldi concertos from Estienne Roger, and he brought them home and shared them with the young house organist who had just started working back in Weimar, whose name was Johann Sebastian Bach. So that's the first movement of one of Vivaldi's original concertos from the Estro Armonico, as it was called, the Seed of Harmony, for a loose translation, published by Estienne Roger. Now, Bach took that same music and arranged it for his own use on his harpsichord. Now, in order to make it fit to the harpsichord, he lowered it a step, because the instrument he was playing, like this one, wasn't high enough, didn't go high enough to get, or low enough to get all those notes. Lowered it a step, altered the bass line slightly. But that's about it. But what we just heard definitely sounds like Vivaldi, and this definitely sounds like Bach. So you can just imagine young Johann Sebastian Bach, he's in his mid-20s, alone in the studio, finding this music and pouring through it, just soaking in these ideas, and then putting them to his own use. He was hungry for a structure to his own music, and he was completely ready for the influence that Vivaldi's music would bring. Here's a quote from one of the early biographers of Bach from 1802, wrote this about the music. Bach considered his early compositions to be that of a finger composer, letting his fingers run wild over the keyboard. But he soon began to feel that there must be order, connection, and proportion in the thoughts, and that some kind of guide was necessary to attain these goals. Vivaldi's concertos for the violin served him as such a guide. It's such fresh and wonderful music. And just to recap, because it's such a great number of little coincidences, I don't want to let it go by. You may have already kept track of them, but just indulge me for a second here. If the prince in Weimar hadn't gone to Utrecht to study violin, if Bach hadn't gone to Weimar as soon as he did, if Vivaldi had decided to have them printed in Venice instead of traveling, if he hadn't been fired for those 2 years, that's all it was only 2 years, by 1711, the governors at La Pietà hired him back. And by that time, Bach had already left Weimar. So this is a tiny little wrinkle in musical time where these things connected. And it literally changed everything. Because harmony in Western music basically comes from Bach. Other people were involved, but if it weren't for him, it wouldn't be the way it is now. And it was such a huge event in his life that he came across that music when he did. Now, Vivaldi ended up, as I said, got rehired after a couple of years. And whatever had gone wrong was done with for then. Although a few years later, well, several years later, he stayed with La Pietà for some 26 years after that. There were little falling outs now and then, and he left town once in a while. When the Pope prohibited one of his operas being performed, we think because that relationship with the singer was still going on, he went back to Amsterdam, which was kind of a bohemian refuge then as now. So he went to Amsterdam and hooked up again with the Roger printing house. By then, Estienne Roger had died, 1738. He was a very wealthy man. He left the company to his son-in-law, Le Sen, who very cleverly essentially did what Sony did when they bought Columbia back in the early 90s. He had this wonderful, huge library that was his. Didn't have to develop anything else at all. He just reprinted. Mostly he spent the rest of his years, Le Sen, with this huge library that he reprinted and sold. Cost him nothing, made him tons. Now, in Cremona, in 1714, the economy was still in quite serious trouble. But Antonio Stradivari was not hurting at all. His violin shop was spectacularly busy. He was making 30 violins a year at that point, violins and cellos. And he literally put the Amatis out of business. They had had such trouble, they ended up borrowing money from Stradivari and couldn't pay it back. So like Faust and Gutenberg, he took over their shop. And the Amati family was put out of the violin business by their former apprentice. In the same year, 1714, he made one of his most famous violins, the Viotti it's now called. And this is the one that the Royal Academy of London is right now trying to raise enough capital to buy back so it doesn't have to go to auction. They want to keep it as their property. It's valued at £3.5 million. And the talk is that if it goes to auction, it could fetch £7 million. In 1714, Stradivari was 70 years old, and he began this last extraordinary push to perfect his already perfect violins. He was a control freak and a perfectionist and a very rich man. He had two sons working in the workshop. They were only allowed to make the scrolls, the little things at the end of the violin, and to cut the sound holes. He did the rest himself, even though he was already 70. He invested in a pastry shop that year in Cremona, bought a pastry shop, and he bought a garden outside of the walls of town. But he didn't pay much attention to those or to anything else. He really just worked. He even ignored the musicians who came around his shop, and it became sort of a social gathering place, mostly for the other musicians. But Stradivari, he wasn't talking to anybody. He was making violins. One of the people that came around was the Flemish-born violinist Jean-Baptiste Volumier, who was a court music director in Dresden. He'd been trained in France, so he never got quite past the idea of the violin being a dance instrument. So when he put together his Dresden orchestra, he had them play in a French style, all pomp and dance, but using Italian violins. And he got those violins from Stradivari in Cremona in 1715, when the old master was at his absolute best. Volumier waited for 3 months in Cremona for the violins that he ordered, but he left with 12 Stradivari violins in one shipment and brought them back to Dresden, 12 of the greatest violins ever made. And when he got back to Dresden, everyone was blown away, including the young composer who now was hanging around Dresden, Johann Sebastian Bach. Can you imagine? This was his first big orchestra experience. 12 Stradivari violins, all in one place. He never thought of the violin the same way again. Thank you. Bach moved to Köthen in 1717 in a new job, court music director for the barely 20-year-old Prince Leopold, who was a music lover. But 3 years later, the prince married, and his wife hated music and wasn't a big fan of Bach's either. And then Bach's wife, Maria Barbara, died. She died earlier that year. And those two things were enough to have him looking for a new job again. So he remarried just months later to Anna Magdalena, the daughter of a court trumpeter. You know, that's not why he married her necessarily, I don't think. But he did become a big fan of the trumpet. And I suspect that his trumpet writing changed. When your father-in-law's looking over your shoulder, you might think of the thing a little differently, I suppose. And so there was a great court trumpeter at his new job in Leipzig, who, if he wasn't a father figure to Bach, certainly was to every trumpet player who has lived since. And that's Gottfried Reicha, who I believe is up there. Yeah, that's Gottfried Reicha, holding that clarino trumpet that he played. And the little scrap of manuscript in his hand is actually a test piece that he wrote, which was used as the standard to judge whether a trumpet player was good enough in Leipzig for decades afterwards, because he was such a master of the trumpet that it was considered that if they could play Reicha's test piece, then they deserved the job. He was almost 20 years older than Bach, Bach used every ounce of his creative energy writing these wonderful parts for this dazzling genius of a trumpeter. The parts he wrote were fast and high, and in some ways you could argue that Reicha's brilliance actually slowed down the trumpet's progress. Because the instrument that Reicha was playing, as you see, was just a long coiled tube. And he had such ability that he could play almost anything on that anyway. So it was another 70 years before anybody thought to improve the design of the trumpet at all. It simply wasn't necessary. So as Stradivari raised the violin with his workshop tools, Reicha kept the trumpet where it was with the strength of his chops alone. And in the end, it cost Reicha as well. Gottfried Reicha died of a brain hemorrhage in 1734. The injury very likely brought on by the incredible music written for him by one very demanding organist. Thank you. Bach was still working for the young Prince Leopold, the music-loving prince in Köthen, the prince went to Carlsbad, where there was a hot spring, kind of a medicinal taking of the waters. And he brought along six musicians and a harpsichord. Next time you take a bath, you can think about that, if you like. And one of those six was Bach. And somewhere around that trip, Bach turned up in Berlin. He paid to have some work done at the bindery. And this is the sign of the eventual triumph of engraving over type-based music printing, is that he didn't have to be a master like Roger was to do it. Bach eventually got to engraving his own pieces. And this is likely what he was having done at the bindery, was having his own music bound after he'd mastered the art himself. It was simple and easy to use, even though it was counterintuitive in terms of technology. It was a step backward in the complexity of the technology, but it worked. One of the pieces that he did, he printed himself with his own engraving, was the E minor partita for solo violin, inspired by the wonderful possibilities he discovered with those 12 Stradivari masterpieces in Dresden. He revised the piece in the mid-1730s, which is about the time that Stradivari died, at the incredible age of 93. And he made violins right to the end. He made three violins in his very last year of life. So it's possible that that reissue of the Partita by Bach was a tribute to the great violin maker. But the tenderness of the music also suggests another possibility. In January of 1720, when he first wrote the piece, Bach went back to Carlsbad, to the springs, with the prince for several months. And while he was there, while he was in Carlsbad, his wife died, Maria Barbara. It was so sudden that Bach couldn't get back in time for the funeral. He couldn't get back in time for the burial. They had several children by then. The oldest was 9, Wilhelm Friedemann. And when Bach got back from Carlsbad, the mother of those children was already in the ground. He remarried and enjoyed a famously successful partnership with the singer and copyist and teacher Anna Magdalena Bach. But when you listen to the music that he wrote around the time of Maria Barbara's sudden death, it's easy to see how a lone violin, once the entertainment for peasant dances, with all its warmth and sensuality, qualities that eventually won over musicians from then on, still spoke to him and to generations of musicians after, like no other instrument ever would.